VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
Hello, friends. We thank you for joining us to a very must-listen-to program today. Increasingly, we are hearing a rallying cry for socialism, socialism in our society. Free health care, free education, free food, free housing, free public transportation, free child care, guaranteed jobs, free welfare for the poor. Certain politicians are fanning the flames of the mobs to change our government, our constitution, and our way of life as a nation. Do we really want to go the way of Russia, of communist China, of Cuba, of Venezuela? Is socialism a wonderful utopia, or is it a totalitarian nightmare? Will everything be free, or will the deep state bureaucrats decide who gets what? Is there a difference between socialism and communism? Well, these are some of the many questions to be addressed in our program today as we welcome back William Federer. Bill is a nationally known speaker, historian, author, president of Amerisearch, Inc. That's a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. He's a speaker on the American Minute Daily Broadcast. He has authored numerous books, including America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations, The Original 13, A History of Religion in America's First 13 States, Who is the King in America? And the newly released Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present, in which he analyzes how the deep state capitalizes on crises to consolidate control. Bill, welcome back here to Crosstalk.
Tim, great to be with you.
Let's begin with that fundamental question. Where does term socialism even originate?
Well, the concept goes all the way back to Plato, and he lived 380 BC, and in passing he mentions Atlantis, this highly structured, advanced society that is destroyed in an earthquake and sunk beneath the ocean. But he keeps referring back to this as his ideal society. So he lived in Athens, and Athens had a democracy. Demos means people, krasi means rule. And he says a democracy won't last. He says it's based on the people having virtue, and they really don't. And so he says the chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance. People tolerate each other. At first, it's charming. Then they begin to tolerate people that are a little bit off. Then they tolerate people that are a lot off. So finally, they're tolerating crooks and crime and broad daylight looting of stores, and nobody even does anything about it. And then it creeps into their morality, and it says the young man gives into libertinism and useless and unnecessary pleasures, even incest and unnatural union. Yes, that's what he's talking about. And it's this casting off of restraints turns into lawlessness. And in the lawlessness, people feel insecure and they begin to say, can't someone come along and fix this mess? And that's when somebody comes along, like a governor or a mayor, and says, okay, I'll restore order. I just need to temporarily take some of your rights and some of your freedoms. And before you know it, this person stands in the chariot of state holding the reins of power and they're revealed as the tyrant. Hmm. And so Plato, his basic theory is that democracy without virtue ends in domestic social chaos out of which some governor or mayor will be a tyrant. And then he says that this tyrant will then begin to consider himself the head of gold, and his administrations and military will be the arms and chest of silver. And then the people way down below, they are the abdomen of iron and bronze. And so socialism is a structured society with two tiers, a deep state ruling class and everyone else. And everyone else has no property. They own nothing. They have no privacy. They don't even control their own kids. The state takes the children away from the family. And so this is the concept of socialism. Now, let's skip forward 2,000 years. Columbus discovers America, and 20 years later, you have Sir Thomas More writes Island of Utopia. It's a fictitious island off the coast of South America. The word utopia means nowhere. It's written as a dialogue with a traveler. The traveler's name is Peddler of Nonsense. And guess what? It's like Plato's Island of Atlantis. This is a highly structured society with a ruling class, a ruled class, and the ruled class own no property. They live in identical three-story houses, and they wear identical clothes. They eat in identical communal eating like monasteries. Their kids are taken away. That even the government decides who even gets to have children or who doesn't. And you're tracked everywhere you go. If you're traveling without your papers, it's a lifetime of slavery. And so this is utopia, right? This highly structured society. Now, another century forward, you got the Pilgrims. You got Sir Francis Bacon, and he writes The New Atlantis. Actually writes this book, The New Atlantis, referring back to Plato's Atlantis. This is an island in the South Pacific. Again, a guy's washed up on the island. It's highly structured. Guess who wrote a mockery of this satire? It's Jonathan Swift, and his book is Gulliver's Travels. There's Gulliver washed up on an island, and it's this ridiculous ruling class, and they control everyone's lives, and then the common people, they have to do what they're told. And anyway, why is this important? Because the Pilgrims originally were a company colony with bylaws written by some rich investors in England, and the investors looked back to Plato, Sir Thomas More, Sir Francis Bacon, and lo and behold, the bylaws said that everything the Pilgrims had would be owned in common. Everything gained by cooking, hunting, fishing, trading shall go into ye common stock. And everyone's livelihood will come out of ye common stock. And William Bradford, the governor of the Pilgrims, said they almost starved to death. He says this was tried by well-meaning people, but he says this shows the emptiness of the theory of Plato, applauded recently by some in England. So he's still referring back to this Plato experiment. Wow. He says that the taking away of private property and owned in a communal setting would make men happy as if they were wiser than God.
And Bill, this is where some would say Pilgrims were promoting communism, but they weren't doing that.
Right. William Bradford says it bred much confusion. The young man objected to having to do twice as much work as the old man, but not getting any more recompense. He says the creative and resourceful man didn't get any more. He had to work for other men's wives without any, you know. And then he says the women, they objected to having to wash other men's clothes. And he says that they almost starved to death because no one wanted a plan. So William Bradford says they had to come up with a fitter plan. After much discussion, it was decided that every family would get their own plot of land. This made all hands more industrious, he writes. He says even the women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them, where before to have forced them would have been considered great oppression. So here the Pilgrims tried it. It didn't work. And they said, scrap this. Everybody get your own plot of land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is all the Plato, Sir Thomas More, Sir Francis Bacon. That's all theoretical. The Pilgrims actually tried to live this thing out, and it failed. And so you see this keeps coming back over and over again. It's basically the dream of heaven on earth. And it's a cultural bait and switch. I mean, here you have shysters selling used cars. Oh, it's really good. But then you drive the thing off the lot and it's no good. Well, this is a cultural bait and switch. This socialism is really good. Every single place where it's actually been tried, it fails. And the naive next generation says, well, it failed because the people that did it weren't as committed as we are. We're going to try again. And it, guess what? It fails again. And so now we fast forward. And after the American Revolution, France has a revolution. We had a Great Awakening revival prior to ours. France had this Voltaire wanting to erase Christianity. And so first in France, they decided to chop off the head of their king and queen. Things didn't turn around. They chopped off the heads of the royalty. Things didn't turn around. They chopped off the heads of the wealthy. Things didn't turn around. They chopped off the heads of the business owners and farmers. Things didn't turn around. They chopped off the head of the hoarders, the people that had extra food stored up in their basements and attics. They still didn't turn around. Then they chopped off the heads of the preachers who were preaching against the head chopping off stuff. Then they chopped off the heads of the former revolutionaries, the ones who used to chop off heads but got tired of it. Somehow they're to blame. 40,000 people had their heads chopped off in Paris, France. And so then they came up with their liberty, equality, fraternité. And the word fraternity is French for socialism. And so every socialist revolution since looks back to the French Revolution. You kill off the old order, and then you're going to do something new. But guess what? The something new turns into chaos because there's no morals. And in France's case, they got a dictator named Napoleon. So they started off, instead of a king, they had to have now with an emperor, Napoleon. And And then you see where Napoleon conquers Europe really fast, and the king of Prussia said, and Prussia is one of the German kingdoms. His name is Frederick, and he says that we can't get conquered that easy again. We need to strengthen our Prussian state. And he needs a philosopher, and so he gets one named Hegel. He's a professor at the University of Berlin. And Hegel says, okay, the state is God walking on earth. The state is our mortal God. He says all the worth that a human being possesses, he possesses only through the state. And so Frederick of Prussia says, great, I love this guy. And so he spreads this all around Germany. That laid the groundwork for Hitler and all the rest. And who was a member of this radical student group at the University of Berlin where Hegel taught? Karl Marx.
Wow.
So Karl Marx, the state is God and everything, that all begins at this time.
Bill, now, on Hegel, there was something known as a Hegelian dialectic. What is that?
Well, that's the concept where in times of crises, people panic and give up their freedoms. Let's create crisis. Let's speed it along. And so Hegel's way of creating crisis is a triangle. One corner of the triangle is a thesis. The opposite corner is an antithesis or antithesis. The top corner is a synthesis. It sounds complicated, but it's not. In other words, you start off with the status quo. You create a problem that is real bad. And then everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And that's the new synthesis. So that's the starting point. And then you create another problem that's real bad. And everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And you keep doing this because after every crisis, people surrender a little more of their freedom, a little more of their independence to the government. And before you know it, you've crossed the page from the people ruling themselves bottom up to a dictator, tyrant, governor ruling from the top down.
Amazing, amazing how we have swallowed hook, line, and sinker that dialectic. So, Bill, you brought Karl Marx into the picture here then as well, as he was infatuated with Hegel.
Right. So Karl Marx says, okay, how do you create an antithesis in a country? Well, you send in agitators, agent provocateurs, provoking agents, community organizers, labor organizers. Their job is to identify people groups with grievances. And whether it's the rich against the poor, the blacks against the whites, the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners, or whether it's the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo or Rwanda, or the Muslims against the Christians or the Catholics against the Protestants. They really don't care who the two sides are, and they really don't care what the issues are. Their goal is to break one into the victim, the other into the oppressor, and then you stir them up till they fight. And when the fighting gets bad enough, everybody is fearful because of this panic that they let go of their freedoms to some governor or mayor that promises to restore order. And when the dust settles, they've just given up their freedom to a dictator. 45 countries fell to communism this way. And then we begin to see it coming across the ocean to America. Now, one of the first...
Tell you what, this is a good stopping point. We're up against a break. Bill Federer is with us today, going through the history of socialism in rapid fashion today. We'll be telling you how you can obtain a copy of his brand new book that's come out on this issue. But folks, there's more learning we need to all do on this issue. So let's take this break. We'll be back in a minute. And how did this come to America? Back in just 60 seconds.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, scientist and creation seminar speaker with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, do creationists sometimes use bogus arguments for creation?
Unfortunately, they do, Chris. Some favorite arguments that sound so good really aren't well established. Thankfully, there is plenty of good evidence that creationists can use. One example of an outdated argument is the possible human footprints found in the same strata as dinosaur footprints in Texas. Now, I was one of the original developers of this theory and published the authoritative book on it. But the more research we did, the more we saw problems. So I removed my book from the market and we no longer use that claim. I feel it's too ambiguous to use. Now, others still do use that argument, and while I don't oppose them, I do encourage them to use the better evidence. True evidence for creation is strong and convincing, especially as we use that back to Genesis perspective.
This is Chris O'Brien. Thanks for going back to Genesis.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. William Federer, our guest today, he's written a fantastic book to really enlighten our eyes to what's happening in our society today. It's called Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present, How the Deep State Capitalizes on Crises to Consolidate Control. And we're getting a bird's eye view of this here today on the program. As Bill has talked about, the very earliest days of this, originating with Plato, who planted the seeds of socialism. We've seen it come through Hegel and Karl Marx coming into this, the important aspect of agent provocateurs. And Bill, let's pick up. You were just talking as we're going to the break about this coming to our American soil. So pick up at that point, if you would, and tell us about one named Eugene Debs as well.
Right, so in the late 1800s, a lot of German immigrants came to America, and they brought a lot of the Hegelian type thought. And so, one, you had Chicago. You had the Pullman Railroad Car Company. George Pullman, nice guy, builds little village for the workers to live in, builds little shops for the people to shop in, and then he has the factory for the people to work in, little nice setup. But then there was an economic crisis, and the orders for railroad cars dropped off. And so the people were not happy, and so Eugene Debs comes over, and he organizes all these dissatisfied people to riot. And they riot and destroy $80 million worth of railroad cars crossing 27 different states in America, the Pullman Railroad car strike. And finally, the president, Grover Cleveland, had to send in the U.S. Army to restore order in the country. Debs is put in prison, he gets out, and he starts the Socialist Party of America.
Hmm.
And he runs for president five times between 1900 and 1920. Matter of fact, one of the times he actually ran from prison. Well, in 1920, splits off the Communist Party USA. And they run a candidate for president every year from 1920 to 1940. But then during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt decides to make a treaty with Stalin. And the Communist Party USA said, well, why should we run another candidate when here we have a president that's making treaties with the communists in Russia? So from 1940 on, the Communist Party USA just decided to support the Democrat Party. Well, we have America, but let's go over to Germany. And so Germany, you had a republic, the Weimar Republic, and Hitler was voted in by one vote as chancellor. It was very contested, but he finally gets in as chancellor. Immediately afterwards, Hitler has a violent group, sort of an Antifa BLM-type group, led by the radical homosexual Ernst Röhm. And what does this group do? They're the brown shirts, and they're also nicknamed stormtroopers because they would storm into the meetings of Hitler's opponents and shout down the speakers and totally disrupt the meeting. So they couldn't organize against Hitler. And then these brown shirts would lock arms and block access to buildings.
My.
And then they would lock arms across streets. Could you imagine people locking arms and blocking streets?
And it's
then happening
today.
They went
today.
Into the city and they smashed windows and set on fire and looted over 7,000 Jewish stores and synagogues in the night of broken glass. And then the Capitol was set on fire. And in the confusion, Hitler rounds up all his political enemies, has them shot without a trial, and then Hitler has all the brown shirts killed in the Night of the Long Knives, and everyone praises Hitler for cracking down on this violent troublemaking group, and then finally the dust settles and they all realize we just gave up our Weimar Republic and now we're ruled by a dictator, Hitler. And so this model was adapted after World War II. So World War II ends, Germany, France, England give up their colonies, and brand new little countries are formed with brand new leaders. It's wonderful, except the Soviet Union decides it wants to infiltrate these countries and make them satellites of the Soviet Union. And so they would send their KGB agents into Romania, into the Czech Republic, into Poland, into Hungary, Syria, and these KGB agents would identify people groups with grievances. Maybe they've been economically on the bottom of the ladder. Maybe they're ethnically discriminated against. Maybe they're racially discriminated against. Maybe they're religiously discriminated against. And they would organize them into victims and oppressors. And then they would stage riots and protests. And then they would smash windows and set buildings on fire. Then they would co-opt the media through bribes and threats to blame the leader of the country for all of these problems. And then they would cultivate weak links in the military. And when the public got confused and panicky enough, they did a coup or a rigged election, and they would stick in a Soviet puppet leader. And at first, everybody was happy that the violence suddenly stopped. But then when the dust settled, they realized they were just condemned to a totalitarian dictatorship. Well, Truman does nothing when the Soviets begin to do this because he thinks his United Nations will bring world peace. But the next president, Eisenhower, decides to fight fire with fire. So Iran has a leader, Mossadegh, who decides to align with the Soviet Union and nationalize the Iranian oil industry. You say, so what? Well, wait a second. Winston Churchill changed the British Navy from coal to oil. Britain really didn't have any oil. And so in 1908, they formed the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. You know it better as BP.
Oh, my. My.
British Petroleum is the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And when Mossadegh nationalizes it, Britain has no oil, except for a little bit from Trinidad. And so the British go to Eisenhower for help. Eisenhower has his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, approve the first CIA operation to overthrow a country's leader. It's Operation Ajax. And we send over a CIA operative named Kermit Roosevelt Jr., and he does the KGB thing. He recruits the most feared mobsters in Tehran, radical imams, criminals, convicts, and he staged protests and then riots. And then they attack mosques. And then they co-opt the media with bribes and threats to blame Mossadegh for all of the problems. And they nurture relationships with weak links in the military. And when the public gets upset enough, they put Mossadegh under house arrest, lock him away for the rest of his life where he dies, and they install the Shah. And the Shah of Iran loved America because we put him in. We do the same thing in Guatemala, 1954, the Congo, 1960, Dominican Republic, even Chile, 1973. Well, guess what? The KGB did the same thing. And they did it in, you know, Romania and Syria and then, you know, different countries in the Middle East. And and there's pictures of Brezhnev hugging Yasser Arafat and helping him to start the PLO. And Brezhnev hugging Castro and helping him to take over Cuba. And Latin and South American countries, and then in Africa, and then the Chinese did the same thing in countries in the Far East. This is called the Cold War.
Hmm.
And it's the basis of every spy novel. You go to some third world country, and what do you run into? The Russians, the KGB, and then you run into the CIA, and they're going to do a assassination. The only difference this time around is it's taking place on American soil. We all know that there are people in the CIA that do not like our president,
right,
and the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and they've been trying to get rid of him. But they've been doing these operations in other countries for 70 years. And here, lo and behold, you have pallets of bricks dropped off right where they're about to have a peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Emporia, Kansas, 6 weeks ago. And they were telling me, yeah, somebody dropped off a pallet of bricks. There was no construction around, but it just happened to be right where they were planning to have a peaceful protest. It's like, this is tremendously organized. And, you know, I'm from St. Louis originally, and I'm 30 minutes from Ferguson, Missouri. I've spoken in Ferguson, the First Baptist Church, there many times. Anyway, the 99% of the people rioting in Ferguson were not from Ferguson. They were brought in by MORE, M-O-R-E, Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment. And anyone can do a Google search. MORE got $30 million from George Soros. And they had their training in some, you know, inner city churches on how to lock arms and block highways and even how to give emotional speeches when the camera is in your face, telling them the audience is the country, not the person standing in front of you. And so after they trashed Ferguson, they weren't paid right away. So they went to the MORE headquarters and took over the office. And they started a hashtag cut the check campaign, and even the city council in St. Louis condemned it. It made local news, but then they hurried up and cut the check and paid them off. But it was a rent-a-mob. They moved the same people to Milwaukee, to Baltimore, to Charlotte, North Carolina. And the idea was to create a bad enough crisis so that the previous president would have an excuse to come in and take over the local police departments and begin to assume this authority there. And a monkey wrench was thrown in their works when Trump got elected. But we see this response to the COVID has some interesting features to it that you look at it. What was the immediate response to COVID in Democrat City? Let the criminals out of jail.
Yep.
Like, okay, then crime goes up. We didn't see that coming. You let criminals out, crime goes up. I mean, we're talking ISIS members. We're talking MS-13 members. You let them out. And when crime goes up in a city, what happens? Some people feel unsafe and they move out. Who? Maybe those with children, with families, certainly those with enough financial resources to be able to move out. Okay, those people are mostly in a certain political party. Well, who's left in the city? Maybe more people dependent on government entitlements and benefits and you know, handouts. Well, those tend to belong to a particular political party. And then they shut down businesses. And so pro-business people move out. Okay, well, they usually belong to that first political party. Then they shut down churches, which is where pro-life social conservatives organize. Okay, well, they're not there. And then they let the students out of school. They shut down schools. Well, now these students that have been indoctrinated with Hate America, Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States, that nothing does nothing but instill hatred into the kid for their country, and they let them out. Did you know that 75% of the Black Lives Matter rioters are not black? They're spoiled high school and college kids and, for some reason, single middle-aged women. And they are the ones doing the rioting. And so we see that the response to the COVID, let the criminals out, shut down businesses, shut down churches, those with one political party move out of the city, who's left, those that have dependence on another political party. It basically, the COVID response favors one particular political party. And so when the one moves out, they're left in charge of city politics. And in presidential election years, whoever wins the big city wins the state. Whoever wins the state gets all the electoral votes for the state, and the president is elected by electoral votes.
Yes.
So there's a clear political advantage to one party in the COVID response.
Friends, we're going to be taking a break just a minute from now. I've got a few more questions I'd like to ask Bill, but this is all playing out. I mean, this history repeating itself right before our very eyes. I can see Bill is doing just a wonderful overview of all of this, but he's got details in this brand new book that's come out, Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. We're making this available for a donation of $18 or more to Crosstalk. It's available on our website at vcyamerica.org, vcyamerica.org, or you may call right now to our switchboard at 800-729-9829. That's 1-800-729-9829. Your donation of $18 or more. I'm going to be quoting from this book right after the break, folks, as we look at what was revealed, the communist goals. And these were revealed, as reported in the Congressional Record, in 1963. You tell me if these things have not come to pass in our nation. Back in just 1 minute, you're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America.
Cemeteries and mausoleums are evidence of the sad reality of death, and that each of us has a divine appointment with death. According to surveys, Americans overwhelmingly believe that heaven exists and believe that most are going there. A small number believes that hell exists, with only 0.5% believing they will go there when they die. What if those who do not believe in hell die one day and find they made a tragic and eternal mistake? In the book, Hell is for Real, author Gary Fraser discusses the separation, the suffering, and the sorrow of hell, along with future events that will unfold. There is much information given by movies, television, psychics, and even by many religious circles. Gary presents scriptural truth on this important topic. VCY is making available the book, Hell is for Real, as our way of saying thank you for your support of $15 or more. Two copies for a donation of $25. Just ask for it when you call 1-800-729-9829.
You're listening to Crosstalk on BCY America. And friends, if you really want to understand what's going on today, these things are not by accident. No, it's all part of a plan. Bill has laid it out so wonderfully in his book, Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present, how the deep state capitalizes on crises to consolidate control. Again, this book, let me just go here to page 196, where Bill outlines in his book, he recites communist goals. This is a list of these subversive communist goals for America. It was disclosed by Congressman Albert Herlong Jr. of Florida, who read this into the congressional record in January of 1963. January of 1963. Listen to some of these goals. Capture one or both of the political parties in the United States. Use technical decisions of the courts to weaken basic American institutions by claiming their activities violate civil rights. Get control of the schools. Use them as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda. Soften the curricula. Gain control of all student newspapers. Use student riots to foment public protest against programs or organizations which are under communist attack. Infiltrate the press. Gain control of key positions in radio, TV, and motion pictures. Continue discrediting American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. Eliminating good sculpture from the parks. Eliminate all laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and a violation of free speech and free press. Break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity in books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, and TV. Present homosexuality, degeneracy, and promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Infiltrate the churches and replace revealed religion with social religion. Discredit the Bible. Eliminate prayer, any phase of religious expression in the schools on the grounds that it violates the principles of separation of church and state. Discredit the American Constitution, calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step with modern needs. Discredit the American founding fathers. Present them as selfish aristocrats who had no concern for the common man. Belittle all forms of American culture and discourage the teachings of American history on the ground that it was only a minor part of the big picture. Infiltrate and gain control of more unions. Infiltrate and gain control of big business. Discredit the family as an institution. Emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents and create the impression that violence and insurrection are legitimate aspects of the American traditions. And it goes on. But folks, that's right where we are here in this year. And it's laid out that those pages alone where you understand. And this was read in 1963 into the congressional record. Again, this book is available. Our way of saying thank you for your support of $18 or more. It's available online, vcyamerica.org, or by calling 800-729-9829. And Bill, when you read through these, and I went through them fast, you've got more detail than what I read. But from 1963, it's like they were painting a picture of where we are today.
Right. So when we won World War II, this was a two-front war. The Soviets realized they could not conquer America from the outside, so their next thought was to conquer it from the inside. So it's called the Fifth Column, where you infiltrate a country. That goes all the way back to Alexander the Great's dad, Philip of Macedon, and he was wanting to conquer Athens, and he couldn't, but Athens was a democracy run by the people, and so Philip of Macedon realized he could bribe some of the citizens of Athens to spread confusion in their city meetings, and it so confused the city that they couldn't mount a defense, and Philip was able to take over. So the Fifth Column is this idea that you have someone on the inside sowing confusion, and so this concept was what the Soviet Union did beginning in the 1960s. And now, even though the Soviet Union is not around, these tactics are still being embraced. And there was a Yuri Bezmenov, a KGB agent that defected to America, and he did an interview in 1984. And he says, most people think of KGBs and spies like James Bond. He says, that's a very, very small percentage. He says, most KGB agents are involved in demoralization. He says, what's that? They identify the public opinion molding areas of a country. The preachers, the news broadcasters, the Hollywood actors and actresses, and they would co-opt them, and they would begin to push a hate America message, but actually it was hating whatever the country was. So when Mao Zedong took over China, he did a hate Chinese founders message. It was called the Cultural Revolution. And they trashed 5,000 years of Chinese culture. Why? Because they wanted to erase the past, get the people into where they don't remember where they came from. Then you can sway them into the new, brand new People's Republic of whatever.
Hmm.
And so the large part is this demoralization. It's a rotting from the inside.
Yeah.
Then he said there's, and that goes on for 20 years because that's the amount of time it takes to educate a generation. The next is destabilize, where you actually weaken the economy, weaken the military. The third stage is short. He says it's only 6 weeks. It's a crisis.
Hmm.
And then in the crisis is when they switch the power, and then it's called normalization. But he says that's satirical because when Brezhnev went into the Czech Republic with his tanks, he goes, now we're going to normalize things. In other words, that means we're taking over, and you're going to get used to the new normal.
The new normal, yep. And, Bill, we keep hearing that over and over. We're looking for the new normal, the new normal. And we're infiltrated with that phrase.
Yeah, there's all these different tactics. Another phrase that I think is important is called psychological projection. And people say, what's that? Sigmund Freud, a psychologist, coined the term where rude people call everyone they don't like rude. Right? Little kids do this. I didn't start it. You started it. And so this is where you'll have a wife beater beat up his wife and say, well, it's your fault because you provoked me. Or a Muslim Sharia man will rape a woman and say, it's your fault because you tempted me. Or Sharia Muslims will come into a very tolerant community and accuse their host of being intolerant.
Right.
And then it got its way into politics. And so David Axelrod was the previous president's campaign manager. And he said in NPR radio, he says, in Chicago politics, we have a tradition where you throw a brick through your own campaign office window and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent. In other words, you do the crime and you accuse your opponent of being guilty of the crime. Their name gets smeared with it in the press over and over again, and most people only read the headlines. And if anybody does point back at you, by that time the water is muddied and the public doesn't know who to trust, and you get a pass.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this is used every single day. Well, they'll say, well, the president is a racist, you know, or this person, this group, they're homophobe, they're you know, intolerant, they're racist. No, wait a second. The person that's throwing out the accusation is really the racist, the hateful, the intolerant person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Bill, as you pointed out earlier, I mean, we are finding so many groups that are coming together, whether they be the abortionist or the LGBT activist, joining forces with those within Islamic groups, and on we could all add these groups together. But people are coming together who necessarily don't get along with one another, but they have the common enemy, which is our constitutional republic that we have, our form of government, etc., that they are seeking to overthrow in that regard.
Yeah, and they will. It's sort of interesting. Yuri Bezmenov talks about this. He said no. The interviewer said, well, what about the people that are supporting socialism? He says, they'll use them until the socialists take over. Then they bring them all out and shoot them.
Wow.
And he goes,
wow.
Shoot them. Why shoot them? He said, well, because once they realize it's not what they were promised, they end up becoming the biggest enemies of socialism. And we don't want enemies, so we'll just get rid of them.
Right.
And he talked about people in Nicaragua that helped the socialists take over. And then when they realized it wasn't what they ended up fighting the socialists, so they want to get rid of those people. Lenin is credited with calling them useful idiots.
Voter fraud. Voter fraud fits into all of this too, does it not?
Right. So in the strategy of the KGB and the CIA with Kermit Roosevelt Jr. co-opting the media, the idea is you would release false polling data prior to the election, showing the leader as being unpopular. Why? So that when you would do the voter fraud in the rigged election, everyone would say, well, we expected it. And so there's actually part of the strategy is to intentionally release false polling data showing the candidate who's in an office that's really popular, showing them as unpopular. Another tactic is called seizing the moral high ground. And you say, what's that all about? Casinos do it. So if a casino is going to move into an area, opponents will say it'll bring drugs and prostitution and crime and sex trafficking of children and all this kind of stuff. But if the casino gives a little money to the schools, they can seize the moral high ground and say, we care about the children. And if you care about the children, you'll vote for the casinos to come in. And if you're not going to vote for the casinos to come in, you must hate children. You're hateful. And so they seize the moral high ground by claiming they're more and more. And so what happened is they're taking an issue, racism. Racism is wrong. It's sinful. God condemns it. The Bible says that, you know, Samuel was telling, you know, Jesse when, you know, young David was coming in. He says, the man looks on the outward appearance. God looks on the heart. And the Bible says there's no respect of persons in judgment. So God doesn't look at your skin color. He looks at your heart. And so racism is wrong. It's sinful. And so we'll all agree on that. But what they want to do is they want to say that we are wanting to get rid of racism. But if you go to the Black Lives Matter website, and I encourage every listener to do this, click on what we believe. It has a little thing, you know, what we believe. Just scroll down. It says that they are pushing the transgendered agenda.
Yes. Yep.
They are queer affirming. You say, what's queer affirming? That means you have to silence is violence. If you're not visibly affirming and promoting their agenda, you're hateful. Then it says they want to have get rid of the disrupt the nuclear family. What's the nuclear family? That's the mom, dad, child thing, right? They want to disrupt that as if it wasn't disrupted enough already. Then they want the children raised in villages of these people that don't have traditional morals. And then they want to get rid of heteronormative thinking. What is heteronormative thinking? It's even thinking that there's a male and a female.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're pushing this extremely radical sexual agenda under this seizing the moral high ground banner of we want to end racism.
Bill Fitterer right. with us today, folks. Our phone number to Crosstalk, 800-733-9829. That's 800-733-9829. A brief comment or a question today, 800-733-9829. Bill, we're 60 seconds before the break, and I'd like you to respond to this before that break. We're seeing the sale of guns go right through the roof right now, but I understand gun confiscation is part of the formula to bring about socialism.
Right, and America is unique in this with the individual. One of the founders said, a people that legislate for themselves ought to be in the habit of defending themselves. But other countries in the world, only the kings have it, and Hitler did this. He says, if you want to own a gun, join the military. And so Hitler disarmed all the Jews before he rounded up the Jews to send them to the Holocaust camps and so forth. And in communist North Korea and in China, they disarm the people. So this is one of the telltale signs of wanting to. It's like they'll tell you anything to get you to get the gun away, the same way a parent will tell the little kid that's holding a knife, saying, I'll give you some candy, I'll give you anything, mm-hmm. I'll take you to McDonald's, yeah. whatever, just put the knife down. Once they put the knife down, all bets are off. It's like, and so it's like once they'll promise you anything, but once people give up the right to possess and bear arms, all bets are off, and they'll just take over.
We'll be back in 1 minute. Bill Fitterer, our guest today. Friends, so much in this book. It is right where we are. Maybe the most important book Bill has ever put together, Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present. It's available at vcyamerica.org or by calling 800-729-9829. We'll pick up with some calls after the break. This is Crosstalk.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website's worldviewreport.com. In 1958, there was a very historic book written that all of you should read. You'll find it for free online. It's called Color, Communism, and Common Sense. It was written by Johnson Manning, someone I have written and spoken about for many years. He was at one time a very high-ranking official within the Communist Party of America. As a black American, he details how, beginning at least in 1934, Moscow began to try to take over the black churches of America and use them for agitation, for race war, division, and chaos. My friends, you can see what his warnings were all about and how many of the things he warned about, well, they're coming true in 2020. What's really startling is that the tactics that were used to take over the black churches in America by the communists have been largely used to take over the white Protestant denominations in America.
Bill Federer with us here today on Crosstalk, author of many, many books. This most recent one, Socialism, The Real History, From Plato to the Present, How the Deep State Capitalizes on Crises that Consolidate Control. It is an eye-opener. The things that are happening today, folks, they are not by accident. They are by design. Let's go to Mark and Monroe. You're on the air.
My question is this. How would you surmise the Jared Nadler, William Barr Senate hearing the other day in light of the globalist playbook manipulative tactic stunts? It seemed there was somewhat of a stormtrooper strategy involved there.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, I heard someone say that Barr was invited to a campaign photo op. In other words, they didn't want to hear him. They just wanted to get pictures of him looking awkward so they can use in their campaign commercials. No, I think a lot of these politicians are what's called compromised. I ran for Congress 3 times, so I'm familiar with some of the tactics. They'll invite a naive congressman to a party and then maybe put something in the drink and then get pictures of them with underage people. And then from that point on, that politician can give really great speeches, but when it comes down to voting, or in the case of a Supreme Court justice, they'll end up going in the leftist direction.
Yeah.
And say, why would this good guy do that? Well, he's been compromised.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that is the type of tactics they use.
Yeah, all stage. Thank you, Mark. Christine, you're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Federer, would you comment on the fact of the infiltration of the evangelical churches, because the mainline ones have been gone since the 30s and 40s, and the evangelicals now being taken over by the likes of the Gospel Coalition, and we've...
Okay, I tell you what, we're going to just get that out rather than go longer. Bill, what about the infiltration of the church?
Yeah, thanks for that question. That is a very, very serious concern. The woke, the intersectionality, the hate America, this is, it was, Jim, you actually read it in 1963. It says, infiltrate the churches,
yes.
Replace the gospel with social justice.
Yep.
It's like, no, when you become a Christian, you should have some Christian actions that follow, but they want to get rid of the gospel and just have it be actions, and then they want to begin to justify doing violent stuff that Jesus would never approve to push their actions. And so Jesus didn't say, go out on the streets and beat up people and set things on fire to let the world know I love them.
Yeah.
So the people that are pushing this violent social justice agenda are not following the gospel.
Let's go to Doug in Georgia. You're on the air.
Yes, you mentioned the village. That's exactly what Hillary Clinton talked. It takes the village.
Yeah. And that's, thank you for that. And Bill, that's what this is. It is really taking that village. Your children don't belong to you. And we're hearing that more and more. They belong to the state. They belong to, you know, to the common society. We will teach them. Parents, you're a hindrance. And that's all part of it, Bill.
Right. So here's a party that has killing babies in their party platform. And so if they're taking that attitude, when the babies become children, it's, hey, we'll use these children to advance our agenda and teach them all the kinds of sexual perversion that basically 10 years ago would have been criminal. It would have been considered grooming them. But here now we have them pushing it, and it's part of their party platform. They don't value the lives of the children. And if they, and when it comes to black lives, what about the black lives in Nigeria? These Christians that are being killed by Boko Haram, why aren't they concerned about that? Or the unborn babies, the black children are aborted at a higher rate than any other children. They should be condemning that as well.
Let's get to Michael in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're on the air.
Hi, Jim. I just wanted to ask, I'll make this quick and short, but my question was, I've been reading articles and talking about the Great Reset, and wondering if it had anything to concern about the socialist agenda that's being pushed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are you familiar with that term, Bill, the Great Reset?
The financial?
Yeah, the whole United Nations plan coming together as putting a one world entity in control.
Right. This is a big concern. And when you understand the dynamics of using a crisis, Saul Alinsky, Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that you want to take advantage of the crisis to push your agenda, Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto, and Frederick Marx described themselves as alchemists of the revolution, spurring it into artificial crises. Every new crisis must be more serious and universal than the last. Every fresh slump must ruin more small capitalists and increase the number of the unemployed. This will bring a commercial crisis, which will lead to a social revolution. So here Engels talks about intentionally putting people out of work, intentionally ruining small business. Why? Because he wants to have a commercial crisis. Why? Because that'll lead to the social revolution. And their books and their writings talk about tearing down the system. They never talk about what's going to replace it. And what replaces it always ends up being a dictatorship.
Let's squeeze one last question from Gregory, South Dakota. Wayne, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering if your guest has any knowledge of, you know, I've heard of some military people who are patriots who are anticipating, have been anticipating something like this happening to take over. And let's say this fall, if there would be enough voter fraud, if they could engineer it, and the election would be rigged to get Biden in, would there be any recourse, any mechanism that he thinks that enough high-ranking people in the military that aren't deep state and into the...
Okay, I think we got the gist. We're almost out of time, Wayne. Sorry to quicken you there, but Bill, you got 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the same way they've infiltrated, they've used the LGBT agenda to drive out a whole lot of people with morals and values, so that the same way the IRS and these other agencies have been infiltrated, I feel bad that a lot of the military has as well. There's still good people in there, but it's a crisis. As far as mail-in ballots go, I ran for Congress 3 times. Unless you have a Republican and a Democrat election judge following the mail postal worker from every house to their truck, from their truck to the post office, from the post office to the Board of Election, unless you do that, there is no way to secure mail-in ballots. And again,
gonna,
I remember talking to
we're going to have to leave it there, Bill. I apologize, Bill. We've got to leave it there. Out of time. Wayne, thank you for your call from Gregory. Bill Federer with us. Folks, Bill's got so much to say. A lot has been put into this book, Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. It'll give you understanding as to where we are today and why. It's available at Crosstalk, through Crosstalk here, 800-729-9829 or vcyamerica.org. Bill, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and I really encourage everyone to get the book.
Great. Bill Federer and with us today here on Crosstalk. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.